The following is a paid advertisement of St. Anthony Hospital Orthopedics. References to any specific product, services, or entity does not constitute an endorsement or recommendation by St. Anthony Hospital, Carroll Broadcasting, or its advertisers. The views expressed by the host or guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. Welcome to the St. Anthony Hospital Orthopedic Show with Dr. Richard Godding. Dr. Godding specializes in joint preservation, reconstruction, and replacement surgery, and brings over 25 years of orthopedic excellence to St. Anthony Hospital and to the Carroll area. For more information about Dr. Godding, his practice, or St. Anthony Orthopedics, go to stanthonyhospital.org or make an appointment by calling 712-794-5536.
Good Sunday morning, Iowa. It's Dr. Rick Godding. Thank you for choosing to spend a little bit of time with me here today. And, you know, it's funny. I talk about the analogy that I use, and I talk about shoulders. You know, don't let your shoulder pain go so long that it's like what I say is if you're a farmer, you're not going to, you know, let the tractor wheel fall off in the field. And it's funny because I said that a couple weeks ago or so on a show. And that following week, it was probably the week that I said it on the show, but since I record on Monday, right? So that following week, two different people came in and both said that they had kind of heard me say that. One of them had a little bit of a rotator cuff tear and was able to send him for some physical therapy and talk about the potential of doing a Regeniten patch like what I had, which is if you have a partial thickness tear instead of a full thickness tear, which basically means that the rotator cuff tendons are intact but frayed. You can just put the Regeniten on it and it grows over and thickens it up. So we talked about all of his options and sent him for physical therapy. And, you know, he's in now, and if he needs more, we'll see him. And if it doesn't get better, we can do the Regeniten, and then we don't let it get too far gone. And another guy who came in and said he'd been having years of pain, and finally he had heard me say that on the air. And so he came in to check, and sure enough, he had a massive rotator cuff tear, and his humeral head had come up a little bit, so there was no potential. It's the one joint where it's essentially floating and it's held together by the muscle tension and the tendons. So the hip, the socket is resting on the ball. So the weight of the body is on the actual joint, right? The knee, obviously, the femur bone is resting on the tibia bone. And then, you know, it's very much a weight-bearing joint. The shoulder, however, is if all the ligaments and muscles weren't there, the humerus bone would just fall to the ground. So the humeral head, which is the ball part of the ball and socket, if the supraspinatus, which is the main tendon that is over the top of the rotator cuff, and that's typically the first one that tears, and we talked about the anatomy of that, but I'll just refresh you if you've forgotten. Besides the fact that when you do overhead activities, it can kind of pinch a little bit. The rotator cuff can kind of pinch between the bones, between the two bones, the shoulder blade and the humerus. The shoulder blade has a little bone that sticks out. And if you touch the very top of your shoulder, you're touching the top of your shoulder blade. Doesn't seem like it because you think of your shoulder blade being in the back, but that's the same bone. And the humeral head can rub when you're going overhead, it can kind of pinch the tendon between those two bones. So that's one reason why the supraspinatus, the top of the rotator cuff, tears first. The other is the blood supply. I've talked about this before. It's what we call a watershed blood supply, like a watershed. You know, there's flow in and flow out, but there's no actual flowing creeks or anything in the watershed, right? And that's kind of how the blood supply is. Excuse me, I'm a little bit under the weather today. Anyway, that's the reason that the supraspinatus is the one that tears typically, and it also tears right at its insertion onto the bone. So the humeral head, once that tears, the only thing restraining the humeral head from going upwards. And now, why would it go upwards? Well, it goes upwards because all of those other muscles are pulling in what is now a direction that has no longer anything to counterbalance it, right? And so the biceps, the long head of the biceps tendon comes in and attaches to the socket part, and that can kind of hold the humeral head down in absence of the supraspinatus, the top of the rotator cuff. But eventually, if you have a big rotator cuff tear, the humeral head will come up and it will start to rub on the bottom of the acromion, which is a part of the shoulder blade. Once that happens, then you can't do anything other than the reverse total shoulder, where we take the ball out of the ball and we put a metal ball where the socket is and a metal socket where the ball is, and then a little plastic in between. So the second guy had unfortunately waited so long that he now was only able to have a reverse total shoulder, and he just didn't think it was worth all that at this point, which is fair enough. I mean, the thing about the reverse total shoulder, oh, well, let me finish the point of that story, and then we'll talk about the reverse total shoulder. So the point of that story is, don't let your shoulder pain go so long that your options become harder and harder to deal with. You go from a partial thickness rotator cuff tear where you have the Regeniten patch. You put that on there, 48 hours later, you're out of your sling, you're rehabbing. To a full thickness, smaller tear where you put a couple anchors in the bone, you're in the sling for 6 weeks, but you've started some rehab at a couple weeks. And it's kind of a long process, but it usually will be all right. Then you have the massive tear, and that tear is unfixable. And we can do what's called a superior capsular reconstruction, where we take a human dermal allograft and we attach it from the top of the socket to the top of the ball. And then once you can't do that anymore because the humeral head has come up or one of those other operations has failed, you then can do the reverse total shoulder. Well, the reverse total shoulder, you don't have the same range of motion. You do lose some range of motion, about 15, 20 degrees in all planes, and all planes of motion. And you can't lift more than 35 pounds for the rest of your life. And also, I really don't like to do those in people under 70, maybe 65. But the problem is with those is that there's no back out if that fails, okay? Because you've taken out so much bone and the screws are way deep into the socket. And once that thing fails, you know, there's not a real good option. You basically can take out the socket side and then, which is then the ball, and then you take out the humerus side, which has then become the socket, and you switch it around and you put a ball back in there, but then you have no socket and you have a very dysfunctional shoulder. And now that's years down the road, should be 20 years down the road, but you know, 20, 25 years down the road after the reverse total shoulder, if that happens, you don't have a lot of bailout. So I don't like to do it in a 52-year-old, right? Because that person is going to be 70, 71, 72, 73, and they're going to then have a useless shoulder. Now you have to balance that with, well, what if I have a useless shoulder now? Well, if you have a useless shoulder now, then you certainly can do that operation. But I can remember when I was a consultant back in the day when I was working at the University of Illinois, when I was a consultant for Zimmer Biomet, which is one of the big companies, I went over to their headquarters, which is in Warsaw, Indiana. And they wanted me because of some of the work that I was doing at that time and because I had been doing a lot of superior capsular reconstructions. And it was an emerging new procedure. And I was doing some research on it, on shoulders, and I was, you know, doing a whole lot of superior capsular reconstructions. This is back in, 2013, before they were really becoming a mainstream operation. And they wanted me to help design the graft that we use, which I did. It's funny because I got there and they gave me this graft that they had. So they said, this is what we have and, you know, tell us what you would change about it. So it was about the same size as the graft that we ended up designing, but it was stiff. And so you had to put it in fluid for about 45 minutes and then it never was really good. One of the problems with that is a lot of times you don't know you're doing a superior capsular reconstruction until you see it. So if you've got the scope in the shoulder And you see, all right, I can't fix this thing. I need to do a superior capsule reconstruction. We don't want to sit for 45 minutes in the operating room with the patient asleep waiting for this thing. So your choice would be put the graft in the saline solution and get it ready to go. And even then, it wasn't that great. 45 minutes early, and then if it doesn't work, you throw it out, and the hospital eats the cost. So they wanted to do better than that. And so we came up with one, and the Dermaspan, and it's still out there. But the idea of it is that it holds the rotator cuff down, and so we needed something much more flexible. But while I was out there, they were showing me some of their new designs in the reverse total shoulder and things like that. And I was talking to some of the engineers on the team that I was working with, and they said, you know, we're almost frantically trying to come up with a good solution for a failed reverse total shoulder. In other words, like I was just talking about, what do you do when those wear out? And again, most people, if you have it at 70, 75, the chances are at the demand level that you're at, that you're probably not going to have it fail in your lifetime. They're probably going to go 20, 25 years, because at 75, you're certainly, well, most people aren't doing the kind of things they were at 50, right? So, but the engineers were, it was almost like they were nervous. Like they were like, you know, man, what are we going to do when these things start to fail? Now, the good part is, and I will tell you this, I cannot remember seeing, I certainly have not had one of mine fail, but I cannot remember seeing a failure of a reverse total shoulder. I saw one that was infected and I had to take it out and change some things up when it was not my surgery, but I can't remember seeing one where, okay, it's been in there for 20 years and this thing just fell apart. Now, it's only been within the last 10 years that they've really been going in a lot. So I would imagine in the next 5 to 10 years, we're going to start seeing a whole lot of failed reverse total shoulders. But if you've had a reverse total shoulder or are considering it, don't worry about that, because, you know, if you're 65, 70, there's a really good chance that you'll never wear that thing out. And if you're younger than 60, maybe you're in your 50s, and I would say, you know, that's when you have to make a harder decision. But if you have a shoulder that's not functional, not usable, well, you know, do you want to have a functional shoulder for the next 20 years and then worry about it? Or do you just want to start now with having a non-functional shoulder? So, you know, these decisions aren't always easy. You know, it seems surgical decision-making is not always easy. Sometimes it is. You know, the easy one would be, hey, you have a small rotator cuff tear and that's going to get bigger. We should fix it. That's an easy one. You have knee arthritis. You've tried injections and anti-inflammatory medications and all of the other non-surgical treatments for knee arthritis, and it's not worked out. Well, as long as you're healthy enough, you can have a knee replacement, and it's probably going to do great. So surgical decision-making can range from easier to much, much more complex. That's just the nature of medicine. That would be the same in any field. I mean, in general surgery, the same thing. If you have an acute appendix, even that's changing nowadays. It's interesting. I've seen now that it used to be if you have an acute appendix, meaning you have appendicitis, I mean, that thing comes out. But now sometimes they are treating it non-operatively. But so things change, and that's the interesting thing. Things change a lot. I can tell you, in orthopedics, one of the things that I've seen change, and I've seen the pendulum go start in one place, go the other place, and then go back to the other place within the framework of my training and my career, which would span 25 years between the training and the career. The clavicle, the collarbone, when I started, we operated on most clavicles that were displaced even a little bit, because there was a couple of studies that showed that your shoulder function wasn't as good if you didn't fix it, a broken clavicle. Then it went the other way, and it was like, well, I mean, unless that thing is going to come through the skin, you don't operate on it. And now it's come sort of back the other way, where we're operating on a fair bit more of them than we used to. So I've seen these things come and go. And the interesting thing is, if you look at how science works, you can have two reputable, we'll talk about science in respect to orthopedics, two reputable surgeons or groups of surgeons working at two reputable medical schools do a study on a particular treatment, and they can get essentially opposite almost results. And it's just very interesting. Now, why would that be? I don't know. And there's just, things aren't as, science isn't as perfect as it's made out to be in a lot of ways, because, you know, even the journal Nature published back, I think it was in 2015, they published the reproducibility of science experiments. And 70% of science experiments were not reproducible in a second lab that tried to copy. So a scientist will say, this is what we did, this is how we did it, these are our results. So a second group would say, well, let's see if we can reproduce that, because the more times that can be reproduced, the better, right? And then you can really say, well, every time it's been tried, this is how it worked, right? That's science, where you have like, we've done this 10 times the exact same way. It works the same way. Okay, all right, yeah, that's good. 70% of science experiments, and this would include even the biological sciences, even physics, 70% of those were not reproducible by a second lab. And up to 40 to 50% of them were not reproducible when the same lab tried to reproduce their own results. And what that means, I guess my take on that is, there's just so many factors. You don't even know what could be a factor, right? You don't even know. I mean, if you're testing something, I mean, maybe the temperature of the room, I mean, who knows? I mean, there's a million different factors that could go into a certain result, but just kind of interesting. Been interesting to see that evolve throughout my career, to see the pendulum swing back and forth between certain types of treatments and what we do for them. And you know, even the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeons right now is not real hot on the viscosupplementation injections. They're not a big recommended treatment. So that'd be the chicken comb, if you will. But I've been using those for 20 years, and I use them in the following manner. If a patient has pretty well preserved knee, so they're not bone on bone, and they're early on in the process, or well, if they're really early on in the process, sometimes I'll go straight to the viscosupplementation just to try to preserve everything better. But as you get down further in the road of arthritis, you do the cortisone injection, and if that doesn't work or doesn't work long enough, then you go to the viscosupplementation. And I've had patients who, I did cortisone for a year or two and it worked, and then I did the viscosupplementation and we're still doing it years later, and they've not needed a knee replacement. So I, you know, it's just funny that in the context of that, and every orthopedic surgeon I know, every single orthopedic surgeon I know uses viscosupplementation, who treats knee arthritis, I should say, because some orthopedic surgeons, like the sports guys, oftentimes won't treat arthritis. But it's just interesting how these things go. You know, we're always just striving to do the very best thing for each patient each time. And what we're doing is we're trying to look at what everybody else has done based on published research and conversations with other surgeons. But we're still learning. We're still trying to get it right. Things continue to evolve. I mean, you know, like I said, the way we're doing knee replacements now on every spectrum is just way different. Even the materials that we're using, the designs of the knees, everything's radically different than it was 20 years ago. And that is something that I see all the time, because what I don't see all the time is failed knees. It's a lot more rare now than it was 5, 10 years ago, especially 10 years ago. And 20 years ago, when I first started practice, I had a failed knee, meaning when I say failed, I mean that it just wore out over time. And I would have one or two of those in my office every week. And now I'll go months without seeing one. And it's because everything's better. The materials are better. The designs are better. The techniques are better. Especially now that we're doing the robots. Oh my gosh. Like I said, I think in 10 years, everyone will be doing robotic surgery. It'll be just like, who's not having the robot? And 20 years after that, I think you'll almost never see a knee wear out, because they're all being put in perfectly. So anyway, that's my story for today. And I hope everybody's doing well. I hope everybody's not getting sick like I got a little sick. And you have a blessed week, Iowa.
This has been the St. Anthony Hospital Orthopedic Show with Dr. Richard Gotting. For more information about Dr. Gotting, his practice, or St. Anthony Hospital Orthopedics, go to www.stanthonyhospital.org or make an appointment by calling 712-794-5536.